You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalists. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today is Wednesday the 16th of June 2021. Someone sent me a news article where the Biden administration, and as you know, we refer to the Biden, Joe Biden in quotes, because he has no functional control or understanding of anything. The administration is a secretive cabal, using him as a front man. So we always use that, almost sarcastically. Forces in the Biden administration have begun to require people to turn in those on the right of the political spectrum in hopes they would be kept from any kind of violent action. There's an entire the website, turning people in, just like when the COVID was an excuse for that. I don't think what a lot of people realize is that there's nothing new here. This has been going on since the Oklahoma City bombing in 96 or 97. 96. There's really nothing new here. It seems that only when the media puts its name on something, or puts a name on something, then people realize it exists. The cancel culture nonsense. The media puts its own name on something that it's doing. Of course, it's been around since I was in college. There wasn't a name for it, so most people didn't realize it existed. What's happening here, of course, is absolutely nothing new. There's a slight difference, and only is that they're very arrogant in how they go about it. They used to hide it. And one of the reasons they're so arrogant about it is that there simply is no organized opposition. The left dominates every institution, with only a few very minor exceptions. All political factions. Conservatives are just what liberals were 30 years ago. The entire thing is a charade. And because of that, even that, of course, is nothing new. That's been going on for a very long time, too. And shutting down websites and firing people and destroying whole careers and shutting down people's bank accounts and their entire social existence is also nothing new. But when you have no organization or movement, legal or otherwise, meaning, made up of lawyers, like our own version of the ACLU, something like that, they can do whatever they please. You have a lot of spontaneous local acts of defiance, but that can't be much of a threat. It's extremely difficult to see how any nationalist organization could really come into existence, because any leadership would be immediately targeted and their lives destroyed. So a leader would either have to be an intense narcissist, and we've been plagued with those in the past, or someone who knows something that we don't, someone who's made some kind of a deal. And they're pretty easy to spot, because they get treated differently than other people in a similar situation. It's now normalized to throw people out of civilized life. Now, even for being, moderate conservatives. The conservative virtue signaling is not going to save them. And it never does. And I love it when conservatives get canceled, as the kids say, and they start complaining. But they were nowhere to be found when that was happening to people like us. With that in mind, though I was, you know, initially with the Biden turning people in, I immediately went to the Cuban Revolution. We talked about Batista and the Committee for the Defense of the Revolution, something that Castro had created. And it was a localized, you know, block-by-block committee where anyone who disagreed was exposed and dealt with. In his speech organizing this, I believe it was in 1960, Castro said that, he said, because one thing is sure, we have people in all parts of the city. There's not an apartment building in the city, not a corner, not a block, not a neighborhood that is not amply represented here. In answer to imperialist campaigns, we're going to set up a system of revolutionary collective vigilance so that everyone will know everyone else in the block, what they do, what relationship they have with tyranny, that is to say, the Batista government, what they believe in, etc. Remember how Castro is absolutely venerated by the regime. With that in mind, I want to talk about the lack of any institutions that we have, and I want to talk about this relative to the white resistance during the Russian Civil War, specifically Denikin, Kolchak, and Keller. I have a lengthy paper. I have so many things coming on, a book about China. I have so many things going on, I don't know where to even begin. And this is all self-imposed. There's a lot of material on the white movement and their, you know, local institutions that really hasn't been translated, even is not well known, even in those circles, the circles that I'm a part of. Fyodor Keller, one of my favorite white commanders, had his famous quote, and I start off with, he says, "It always seemed to me disgusting and worthy of contempt when people, for personal benefit, profit, or personal safety, are ready to alter their beliefs, and such people are the vast majority." Among Russian nationalists, there is the idea, and I've promoted this in the past, that the whites, generally speaking, were slightly more preferable to the Reds. Problem is that there is no such thing as whites. Whites are a very, very diverse group, and that diversity is part of the problem. There are Reds, since there is a single movement. The role of the church here is, of course, always distorted, because they hold that St. Tikhon refused to bless the whites in their struggle against Bolshevism. It actually comes out, as the Patriarch of Constantinople said at the time, the church should be neither white nor red. The church should be apolitical. As if we all agree on what the term politics means. There's a claim that he refused to bless General Denikin. But there's a reason for that. He refused to bless him because the volunteer army under him was completely dependent on the Entente. And the white leaders were under the provisional government. Despite St. Tikhon at one point supporting the provisional government, he learned very quickly that it was a Masonic sect and rejected it. And it's true that he has refused to bless this. But you have to understand the circumstances there. But people who make this claim, and it comes up quite a bit, I did a whole broadcast on what Christianity and Orthodoxy say about political activity, including forceful political activity. Understand that the white movement had, you know, moderate liberals and socialists all the way to royalists. There is no white movement to support. But the claim he didn't bless the white movement in a specific manifestations is completely false. Most of the Civil War, Tikhon was in confinement. He was in constant surveillance. But even under intense interrogation, he really didn't break. Understand what the word blessing means. From the Greek, it's an act of tremendous importance. People blessing the movement. It's a bestowal of sanctification, an external manifestation of God's mercy. It's almost a sacramental. Ancient Russian legislation always saw the blessing as an essential permission from God, showing the justice of an action. In medieval legal texts, without a metropolitan's blessing, no prince could take possession of an inheritance, nor could he rule, nor could any war begin. And when this was withdrawn, it meant excommunication from the church and deprivation of political power. Parts of Russia under white control did see, of course, like when the Germans invaded later, an explosion of Orthodox life. The Southeastern Council, the All-Siberian Council, did set up a temporary administration. Kolchak announced the recognition of all acts from the Synod of 1917-18, and revamped how the church was to be governed from the political point of view. People also forget the crusading movement in 1919, the Brigades of the Holy Cross, from my other favorite white general, General M.K. Dietrich, one of the two most firm Russian nationalists and royalists, didn't have Russian names, Keller and Dietrich. But the Brigades of the Holy Cross were created as volunteers, mostly refugees from places under Soviet control. This was to be the core of a new counter-revolutionary movement. They understood themselves as a crusading order and used those kind of rules. It's not just a fight against red power, but the red power is representative of a much larger force for evil. It's not just a matter of law and politics, but the very nature of materialism and godlessness. It's a fight against anyone who puts the power of material self-interest, however defined, above the power of God manifest in natural law. But, you know, 1919, especially in places like Omsk and in more obscure parts of Russia, you had the same kind of sermonizing, and the liturgy served as you saw the Council of Clermont in the Western Middle Ages. The volunteers to enroll a fight, and Dietrich's proclaimed the crusade against Bolshevism. And he said, "You are only few, but you are the foundation upon which the new Russia will be built, or Russia will be rebuilt." It's under General Golitsyn. And it was accepted by Admiral Kolchak, and even permitted non-Orthodox to be a part of it for the sake of doing battle with atheism. It's a volunteer unit. It's a vow of fidelity you take. You have to reject all forms of drunkenness in a broad sense, impiety, profanity, oppression of civilians. You could be excommunicated for violating your oath. Every unit had its own patron. They are called brothers. There was complete equality in food, or convenience, or anything like that. You don't necessarily need to be Orthodox. This is a desperate time. You could use all kinds of methods. And they wore a sewn cross on their chest. This is very much like the military formations of Ivan the Terrible, Ivan the Fourth. So in 1922, Zemensky, Vladivostok Cathedral, Dietrich, with the synod behind him, announced his goal to restore the Romanov dynasty, and he was elected temporary, what essentially would be an Old Testament judge. And he was proclaimed the ruler of the Amur state and formed the Zemensky Duma. with including having Islamic and trade union members. And his concept of the state in 1922. We've talked about this before, with this developing social nationalism in Russia at the time of the revolution, this explosion of political thinking. But the main unit of government in Dietrich's mind is the parish. Now, different confessions were permitted, but non-believers were deprived of citizenship. They simply can't be trusted. There's no way to appeal to them. We have nothing in common with them. The parish is governed by a priest and appointed chairman from among parish residents. Parish council is elected by lot. People over 25 years old. You couldn't have any criminal background. And they were divided into groups based on functionality. Education, abilities, skills. And the parish council decided all the administrative and economic and even judicial issues. The central government was, you know, falling apart, so. And he's not the only one. But here you have a white general proclaiming this new Russian idea, which is really the medieval Russian idea. The Japanese in the Far East refused to provide them ammunition, which you'll see again and again. And of course, by October 1922, his army was defeated. The Crusaders of the Cross were defeated by the Far Eastern Republic. 1922, Dietrich and about 7,000 had to go to Primorsky and were eventually evacuated by the Japanese. People forget this explosion of political thinking that occurred precisely at a time where the normal institutions of Russian life had fallen apart, both good and bad. So while Tikhon did not bless Denikin necessarily, but he did Admiral Kolchak and he did Fyodor Keller. Keller is probably the most potent of the monarchists. He refused to disobey his oath to the Tsar. He refused to swear allegiance to the provisional government, and he was dismissed as a result. So he joined Denikin's invitation to be a part of the volunteer forces in Pskov. Then he received a formal blessing from Patriarch Tikhon. And through Nestor of Kamchatka, Vladimir Nestor. And Keller is, you know, one of the more interesting, along with Dietrich's, of the Russian Orthodox, not only military men, but practical theoreticians of government. And so people who talk about, you know, the church not being involved in politics, of course, forget about this. It was even published in the Soviet press. It was in the Omsk newspaper. And even when the Patriarch was hauled in for more questioning, this came up. And it became the grounds for keeping him under house arrest. And this is 1920. And Tikhon said, Tikhon refused to take this back. He was well aware of what happened, and he did not back down. He said during the civil, this is 1923 now, under extreme interrogation, he said, I gave no practical support to the white armies, but he helped Denikin and Kolchak with moral support prior to giving their blessing. Of course, he was under intense interrogation there. So there's no question that the church is a part of this. There is no separation of church life, especially in times of severe dislocation, from the legal order. We define politics, of course, as campaigns, elections, and voting. The most vulgar and uninteresting aspects of politics. Has nothing to do with issues of justice and legality. But Keller has a lengthy military background. He was wounded badly when a bomb was thrown by a terrorist cell in, I think, 1905 or 1906. And straight throughout this period of time, right into the Great War. And was well known for not only personal courage, a complete lack of self-interest, but but extremely popular. He defeated the 4th Austro-Hungarian Cavalry Division, even during the Battle of Galicia. He took 500 prisoners. He rejected the abdication of Tsar Nicholas II, as I've talked about this at great length, that his abdication was a myth, that he did not write that. In my book on the murder of, for the 100th anniversary of the murder of Tsar Nicholas, I go into this in great detail. And he refused to believe he voluntarily abdicated at all. And of course, he wrote this to Nicholas, of course, it never got to him. And then he was asked to swear to the provisional government, and he absolutely refused. He was fired for his royalism, and he wouldn't have anything to do with, for example, the Don region, the volunteer army, because its leaders were not royalists. Any place that he was going to command had to fight under the royalist flag, because the materialism of the Bolshevik movement and their allies could only be opposed by a highly organized idealism of the church. The Orthodox monarchy is precisely this. Interestingly, and I did not talk about this in my book on Ukrainian nationalism, but Keller did work with Hetman Skoropadzin in Ukraine, because he was at war at the time with Simeon Petlura. Now, I stress that the Petlura movement in Ukraine was a wicked group. They were deeply Masonic. The only hope that Ukraine had for legitimate and national royalist independence is Skoropadzin. He built a very successful Ukrainian state out of almost nothing, and demanded it was independent, and received recognition of this independence from most of Europe. How bizarre that the so-called Ukrainian nationalists under Petlura immediately declared war on it. So Skoropadzin appointed Keller as commander-in-chief. And the problem was, though, that he said that the Royal Russia, of course, is a future, which Skoropadzin understood, but the great and indivisible empire was another matter. And he created a division that really was unnecessary. And this was a problem. His movement had, of course, Skoropadzin's forces, Krasnov, Cossack Army of the Don, Ivanov's army in the south, Tundutov's army in Astrakhan, Yudnenich in the northwest, which was, an experienced and substantial force. So this whole volunteer army ultimately under Nikin, but the influence of royalist officers, ruling it, would create this common, very large coalition. Unfortunately, it wasn't to be, partially because the Germans were supporting the Bolsheviks, and Nikin, his great mistake, refused to support anything but the Entente, the Allies. And they demanded an opening of the front against the Germans, and of course, the victory of Jewish Bolshevism. And he was, of course, Keller was going to break with the Hetman over the national issue. Now what happened was, Petlura murdered 33 officers, which of course is a deeply Masonic number, from General Kropichev's force. And he captured and murdered them. And then after that, of course, being outraged, he issued an ultimatum to the Hetman saying, I want full power over everything, including over the Council of Ministers. Which was a bit of a problem. You can understand his reaction, but without tight central control, he's not going to win this. Remember, the Hetman Skoropadzin was so successful in Ukraine that he was loaning money to other white forces. Because Keller refused to modify his notion of a single unified empire, ignoring the Ukrainian state altogether, ultimately he was dismissed. And he said, Keller said, I'm quoting him, number one, I can exert my strength and lay my head only for the creation of a great inseparable united Russia, not for the separation of a federal state. And number two, I believe it's impossible to establish peace in this country without a single power at the present time when the uprising is flaring up in all provinces. And there's some truth to that. The Hetman may have been right. You can't argue with the success of Skoropadsky. But it's important to note that the so-called Ukrainian nationalists were at war with the only man who successfully built a Ukrainian independent state, which is very pro-Russian and very royalist. The notion of independent Ukraine doesn't have to be anti-Russian. Skoropadsky is the example of it. Ultimately, Keller was murdered by Petlura's forces, which is essentially a Masonic sect. Keller was murdered on Sofia Square once the he finally, his movement collapsed. He hid in the monastery and finally came out. And Petlura, the Masonic so-called nationalist in Ukraine, by making war on Skoropadsky and trying to destroy Keller, partially ensured a red victory. So Petlura's movement in the Masonic sect in Ukraine was extremely important in doing the bidding of the Reds. And this is not discussed enough. Denikin, on the other hand, was vaguely liberal in politics. He backed the so-called constitutional monarchy. But he also accepted the February Revolution, slander against the Tsar. He promoted anti-royalist propaganda, sought progressive reform, refused to consider himself political. The military should have nothing to do with politics. And this mentality, of course, also ensured a red victory. Now, back in 1917, Kerensky issued the infamous Order No. 1, which is the democratization of the army. Understand what's happening to the American and Western European armies. Affirmative action. Promotions not based on merit. Feminism. Every liberal agenda imposed on the officer corps. You can just search for all these. They have full, you know, homosexual rights days and domestic violence days and trans acceptance days on Air Force bases. I've seen them all. The same thing happened here. Now, the problem with this is both you know, Kerensky and Lenin wanted the army to be run this way. They actually believed it may have been to make it more successful. But in truth, of course, it makes it impossible to resist anybody. And, of course, he drove out all the patriotic officers. And Denikin refused and rejected the implementation of this order, the so-called soldiers' committees, where they had control over officers. And but even the Minister of War himself, Lutkov, said this project is aimed at destroying the army. Just some argument that breaking down the army is exactly what was leading to a red victory. And, you know, Denikin was very clear. He said the revolution ultimately was a good thing. And of course, he was wrong. Then he says, we look to the future with alarm and bewilderment. There is no freedom in a revolutionary dungeon. There is no truth in the forgery of the people's voice. There's no equality in class bullying. There's no power in that crazy bacchanal. They're trying to snatch everything that is possible at the expense of the tormented motherland. So once he was forced to do things at the behest of the regime, the Masonic cult under Kerensky, he began to see that the agenda was far more than he realized. It did not affect him, however. When the army began to collapse, the provisional government blamed him, which is very typical. They'll destroy something and then blame leaders when it doesn't function. They'll destroy the power of the family, the role of the father, and then condemn this father for not being good at his job. This exists everywhere. They'll create a constitutional monarchy. And for the poor soul who actually fills that role, they'll blame him for everything, but not give him enough power to do anything. This is how it was working at the time as far as the army goes. So the Kornilov mutiny allegedly was inspired by Denikin's rejection of the whole Kerensky regime. The radicalization of the army wasn't just a communist thing. It came from Kerensky too. you need to appreciate just how extremely radical the Kerensky Revolution was. Ultimately, he was removed by the provisional state, and was forced into rebellion at that point. Now, this is very early on, of course. We're moving all over the place. It's this, from 1917, 1923. But how this began, of course, was Denikin's dismissal from the provisional government. That's really when the white movement began. And the volunteer army was developed. And by 1918, he was in full command of the army. Unfortunately, Denikin still had fairly liberal views. And that was based on his support of the Entente. And he truly believed that the British and the French were coming to save him from the Bolsheviks. Like so many people today, they actually believe that they were anti-communist. The officers of the white forces under his command were largely royalist, despite coming from humble backgrounds. But he kind of took the wind out of their sails by rejecting the crown. Of course, in supporting the Entente, he was constantly at war with everything German. And no matter what his supporters said, he refused to make peace with them, refused to have anything to do with them. Now, it's true that they were a part of the Red Movement, but it meant that he was loyal to the Allies, even to his own detriment. The Eastern Anti-Bolshevik Front was destroyed, partially because Denikin refused to leave the Kuban and because he was waiting for the arrival of the Allies there. This trust in the system is what destroyed him. And even when it became very clear that they were not going to support any anti-Bolshevik movement, even by the end of the war, November 1918, it was very clear that not only were they not supporting the white movement, they were supporting the Reds. It took a long time for him to finally realize this, and by then the damage had been done. If you look at this patchwork of white forces that he brought under his command, it was impossible. It was a complete mess. Don Adaban Krasnov, once the Germans left, the Don Army, the Caucasian Volunteer Army, the Army of Wrangel, the Don Army of Sidorin, of the Volunteer Army of Maevsky, in the North Caucasus, General Schilling of Novorossiya. On and on and on. Admiral Gerasim of the Black Sea Fleet. You got irregulars all over the place. This was the white movement. So it wasn't a movement. And no matter how strong, how confused Denikin was, no matter how strong you are, under the circumstances, it simply couldn't be properly led. The Paris Peace Conference, I think, slowly began to alter his point of view. And because he thought that the Russian national movement will have actually a place at this, without realizing that the Allies had concluded a secret alliance with the Bolsheviks. They were a more advantageous force, and they gave slight support to the whites solely to disguise this. But even G.N. Trubetskoy, a relatively liberal figure at the time, said this: the conviction that in Odessa, just like in Paris, the persistent work of Freemasons and Jews, who in every possible way want to prevent the Allies from interfering in our affairs and helping to restore a united and strong Russia, make themselves felt. From some time now, what seemed to be a gross fiction, or a fantasy of the Black Hundreds, who attributed all our turmoil to the work of Jewish Masons, for some time now, began to seem to me to be undoubtedly valid. He wasn't liberal anymore, once he saw how these things actually worked out. But because of the requirements of the Entente, the Nikan had to suppress any movement against the Lodges, the Jewish Bolsheviks. And, of course, he was accused of it anyway, as if this were irrational. Because so many of the Red leaders were Jews, if they were shot, it was an anti-Semitic pogrom. So, the Nikan learned the hard way. He says his army had no representation, I'm quoting him directly, has no representation in Paris, neither in the sense of protecting our interests, nor in informing the West about the activities and military successes of the army in the South, or even a simple refutation of those absurd rumors and stories and myths spread by our enemies. Which is saying a lot for a man who trusted the Allies without question. You need to be clear, in my book on the Soviet Union, the Soviet experiment, which largely deals with this period and shortly thereafter, the small contingents of Allied forces had nothing to do with rejecting the Reds. They could have, but they refused. The point was to create buffer states, making them a cordon. Then Denikin rejected this. They never recognized any of the Russian white governments. Any, of course, Soviet state that we're rushing to be a part of. We'll talk about this in a minute. Once he started talking about this great united indivisible Russia, Denikin then was rejected by the Entente. The fight against the Bolsheviks to the end, which was his big slogan, whatever symbolic support he got from the Allies was gone. He refused to deal with political topics. He claims it's going to be a constituent assembly once the war is won, and that's going to determine the future of Russia. He said, as for me personally, I will not fight for the form of government, I am fighting only for Russia. Which at the time is a meaningless abstraction. It's like people who refer to the American people. American people refer to nothing. And people who use it should be held in suspicion. They ask him what they're talking about, or who they're talking about specifically. There is no such entity. Even here is more abstract. I'm fighting only for Russia. So by 1919, Denikin became, and Kolchak as his deputy, where they both shared power as essentially supreme ruler of Russia. He issued the Moscow directive once he took Tsaritsyn, ordering an advance on the Bolshevik capital. And the anti-Bolshevik forces did very well. By fall of 1919, the whites occupied numerous cities. The Reds began to clear out of Moscow. But for some reason, he couldn't advance a few more miles to get to Moscow. And no one's quite sure what the problem was. Lenin ordered all for the fight against Denikin. What happened? Why he couldn't make that last trip to take Moscow was that the Reds were much better at politics than he was. Nestor Makhno, the so-called anarchist leader in Ukraine, had an agreement with the Bolsheviks, destroyed the white rear guard. He had to withdraw troops from this movement towards Moscow to deal with that. Petlura in Ukraine and the Poles helped the Bolsheviks, agreeing to an armistice with them, and then allowing the Reds to free up forces to go after Denikin. That meant that the Reds were able to field almost 70,000 men, the Whites only 20,000. Red Army counteroffensive led to massive losses. And by early 1920, he had to leave eastern Ukraine, Kiev, Donbass, etc. And this failure sapped the morale of the army. Denikin then says, in a very sad quote, he says, talk about the morality, what was left of Russia when this war was over, or coming to a close. He says, every day is a picture of theft, of robbery, of violence, death throughout the territory under which I have control. He wrote that actually to his wife. He said, the Russian people have fallen so low from top to bottom that I don't know when they'll be able to rise from this mud. Because of the patchwork quilt of this white movement, he couldn't really take decisive measures. Bolshevik propaganda was so better, so much better than the whites had. They simply lied to the peasantry about what they were going to do for them. The whites never responded. Not too long afterwards, the spring of 1920, the Kuban Cossacks fell apart. The White Front dissolved. And then by March of 1920, had to flee via the Crimea. So, the decree of Admiral Kolchak in 1920, Denikin was declared the successor of the official Russian government, supreme ruler. But that didn't change anything, as I mentioned. They had lost faith in this man. And maybe I should modify this. The beginning of the white struggle, I would say, is really 1917. After the Bolshevik coup, General Alexeyev, the 1918, the Northern Army of Miller, who wanted to unite with Kolchak's forces, and of course their great success was the liberation of Siberia by the spring of 1919, and Yudenich, by October 1919, actually, you know, was closing in on Petrograd. Yudenich's forces in 1919, eventually was thrown back to Estonia in the north, and they were interned in concentration camps. And of course, mass executions were demanded. Miller, had to leave for Finland. Then there was a mass evacuation from Odessa to Constantinople. Wrangel's forces resisted in the Crimea until 1920. Then they had to go to Turkey. And the rest, of course, went to China, Turkestan. The Ural Cossacks, Adam and Tolstoy, went through the Trans-Caspian steppes to Mesopotamia. And very quickly, what had begun as a, you know, principled fight, not only against the Reds, but against the provisional government, fell to pieces. Of course, we have to realize the Germans did not fight against the Bolsheviks, supporting them in every possible way. They had to control Russian politics so that a new front couldn't be restored against them. That was the whole point of any Allied intervention. State Secretary von Kuhlmann instructed his ambassador to Moscow. He said, "Please use large sums of money. We're very interested in the Bolsheviks surviving. We're not interested in supporting the monarchist idea that will reunite Russia. On the contrary, we must try to prevent the consolidation of Russia as much as possible. From this point of view, we must support the extreme left." The German representatives in Moscow, and Denikin made this claim, handed over officers from the white underground forces to the Czechists. They regarded Denikin, rightly so, as an ally of the Entente. In 1918, the war ends, and there was hope for support from the West. So many of these people, and we've gone through this before, had this bizarre belief that somehow liberal democracy is not going to accept Marxism. There was a conference in Iasi, Romania. The delegation from a group of the anti-Bolshevik movement. Groups like the Renaissance Union, the Cadet National Center, Council of State, all kinds of groups all over the place. Somehow believing that the Entente will now, the war's over, they'll send help for Russia, because Russia did so much to support the Allied forces during the war. Now, I mentioned this in my book, of course. The Allied generals who showed up to this were ready to provide this assistance. However, they had absolutely no power to do anything. This was a talking shop. They were led to believe that these guys actually were plenipotentiaries of their government. General Denikin was to be the commander-in-chief. This is what they, you know, in Yossi, this is what they came up with. in the forthcoming peace conference, supposed to eliminate competition, and that's what Dedekin was supposed to be, the continuation of old Russia. And it never happened, of course. Now, the Allies were well aware what the Bolsheviks were doing. The Russian delegation at this conference made it very clear, and they sent this to the Allied commanders everywhere. They said, "Great and immeasurable are the sufferings of people living under this regime, most cruel and senseless tyranny. That the countries of the Entente wish to see a new Russia strong and healthy, a member of the family of civilized peoples. If these countries do not want the population of the north of Russia to be died by hundreds of thousands of hunger, if these countries recognize Russia during the first years of the war took a great and glorious participation, making therefore a great contribution to the final victory, that precisely because of her efforts aimed at victory over the common enemy, efforts that surpassed the national forces, she experienced all the inexpressible misfortunes that suppressed her. If the victorious Entente has unshakably decided to revive Russia, the assistance it will render should neither be late nor insignificant. We have no doubt the Allies have already worked out a number of measures, as decisive as they are wise, to eliminate the ulcer of Bolshevism." Instead, the Allies said to begin peace negotiations with the Bolsheviks. The landings in Russia in 1918 existed solely to build a front against the Germans. They were worried about Germans, even in 1919, seizing the resources of Russia. Churchill said this to the British Parliament. The point was to control any rise of Germany, to control any rise of Russia. In March of 1918, prior to the end of the war, the landing in Murmansk was to prevent Germans from using this base for submarines. And it actually was carried out with the consent of Trotsky. The Murmansk Soviet was in contact with the Allies for this landing. Trotsky and Lenin disagreed over their connection with Germany. To save the military warehouses from falling into German hands. So if the Allies were not willing to support the Whites before the end of the war, somehow they still believed in their naivete they were going to support them after the war was over. None of the forces that landed in the Far East, they guarded the railway, none of them were capable of offensive operations. Any of the landings, the interventions of the Entente, were to support the Bolsheviks, at the very least to secure the influence in these newly formed states, especially in the Baltics. The British wanted the Baku oil fields. November 1919, they occupied Baku, the White Command made it clear that the Entente is vehemently, the British especially, anti-Russian. They're at war with the Volunteer Army. The Russians in Tiflis and Georgia were subject to persecution. The Russian church suffered especially under the British occupation. Even Denikin says, "We need the British to clarify whether they're allies or enemies." So as soon as the Germans left the Baltic states, the British moved in to reorganize them for their own self-interest. They demanded the Whites recognize them immediately. Even as Yudenich, as I mentioned, was closing in on Soviet Petrograd, the British refused to assist. Even though Lenin said that they couldn't hold out for much longer. The British armed the Estonians at Trotsky's command. They disarmed the White Army and imprisoned them in winter in concentration camps, as I mentioned. Thousands of them were starved and died of disease. So the Estonians got maybe 1,000 square miles of Russian land under the peace treaty in 1920. And because of that, the Bolsheviks could export gold to other countries. So the French staked out its sphere of influence in Odessa and Sevastopol. Once the Germans were removed, they came in and actually even supported the directory, the movement of Petlura. And of course, this whole time, the Entente is giving behind-the-scenes support, even financing the revolutionary propaganda in Germany, Austria, Hungary. And it really wasn't so much governments, but financial circles. They wanted to see the Russian market. You know, Wall Street sent, you know, W.B. Thompson on the Red Cross mission, who was the director of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, who firmly was pro-red. Lord Milner, one of the heads of English Freemasonry, heavily involved in the February Revolution in Russia, part of the London Joint Stock Bank, he said, the British government established an informal relationship with the Bolsheviks, sending to Russia its Russian-speaking agent, Bruce Lockhart, and then who's Milner and Lord George personally chose for this mission. The French, of course, chose Jacques Sadoul, an old friend of Trotsky's, who sympathized with the Bolsheviks. This is what the Entente did. And with all of this, you still had this bizarre hope that somehow the Allies were going to support the white cause, whatever that might be. There was tremendous confusion. I know this narrative is confusing. 1917 to the end of 1919. But one thing that may make it a bit clearer, the communist leadership did have two vaguely different lines. The Lenin movement, financed really by the Germans in 1917, and Trotsky's group, of course, Jewish nationalist, who was brought to Russia by American bankers. They did have different obligations to, and several, Nazarov, a great Russian writer, has made clear, they may have had different obligations because of this, despite the fact that they were using the same banks in Scandinavia. Trotsky was against the peace treaty that chopped off a lot of Russia and ended the war. The Brest-Litovsk peace, which Trotsky was against, and he advocated a more direct alliance with the Entente against Germany. That was not the case with Lenin. So here you had a clear clash. But the bankers, whether Lenin's group in Germany or Trotsky's group in further west, they were using the Scandinavian countries, banks owned by Warburg, with some general coordination. This is what's behind the rejection of the white movement from the Allies. And you're well aware that there isn't a single textbook, a single book that a professor in Russian history will assign, not a single one that will say anything but the Allies rejected the Bolsheviks, they were at war with them, they intervened to stop them, the whites were supported by the Entente, they wanted to restore the monarchy and they wanted to restore the landlords, even though peasants owned 98% of the land. In 1914. And this is a myth that simply will not die. The cadet leader, A.V. Turkova Williams, who was living in London with her husband, said, and Lord George said this in 1918, one should come to an agreement with Trotsky, who is currently the only statesman in Russia. And this is kind of why, when the British, before leaving the north in Murmansk, they could have handed over the supplies that they had, the shells, to the Russian whites. They destroyed everything in the sea. The Americans, of course, sold their military equipment to the Bolsheviks on credit, on the grounds that they would give raw materials. They used the Red Cross for all of this. Red Cross was an absolute disaster and was used by the regime in the West. And Rangel was absolutely certain that the Red Cross was an intelligence operation where military information was transferred to the Bolsheviks via London. And when Lenin created this fake amnesty, the British demanded that the whites surrender to him. The Americans in the Far East were fully in support of the Red Partisans. And part of the problem with Kolchak's movement was that the Americans were involved in partisan detachments, red partisan detachments that was destroying their rear areas. We've been through many times the reason for the destruction of the whites. The confusion that we're talking about here. This narrative is this patchwork quilt, very much similar to our own circumstances. We have so many eccentrics. You have a few seasoned, intelligent leaders. You have no theoretical foundation. You have an intelligentsia, but very much in their own little islands of theory. The church was being persecuted at the time. The Ukrainian situation, the Belarusian situation, the end of the war, the Baltics, the refusal to recognize, again, Ukraine's at the center, just like in World War II, it was at the center of this too. Refusal to work with the Hetman in Ukraine may have cost the whites the war. The perfidy of Simeon Petlura, working with the Poles to support the Bolsheviks, despite having fought them in other areas. The reason why Udenitz and others couldn't reach Moscow or Petrograd was because of this terrorism to the rear of their armies. The reasons for the white defeat are many. And it's very, very difficult to summarize them intelligently. One important area. The Bolsheviks had no moral code. They didn't actually believe in anything. They were ready to sacrifice everything and anything, including chunks of their own territory. The whites couldn't do this. In the beginning of this talk, I was talking about how, you know, Keller, these people were fired from their jobs. They couldn't adapt to the revolutionary movement. They stood on principle. The Reds had no principles. They had an ideology, which they enforced at the point of a gun. But whether they believed it or not is another matter. This is what they needed to disintegrate the what was left of Russia. Denikin's comment about how the morals had collapsed. You think of World War I and then the Civil War. Warfare will destroy the moral fabric of a country. They're surrounded by death. Everything is based on violence and money and corruption. There is no moral center. Everyone's at war with everybody else. Moral life collapses. Denikin will eventually say this is one of the big reasons for the Red victory. So many ambitious, whether it be, you know, self-styled hetman all over the place, declaring independence. You know, Makhno's role in defeating the armies of Denikin in autumn of 1919, and then Wrangel again in 1920. The terrorism that these groups were using to destroy the white forces in their rear, making their advance more and more difficult. White generals didn't understand civil administration. They had no ideological core whatsoever. Importantly, the white leadership didn't coordinate with or understand the massive peasant uprisings against the red government. The battles between the Red Army and peasant uprisings. Fielded forces where the peasants had three times the men that the whites had against the Reds. A huge third force, completely orthodox. But they never approached it. They never tried to make an ally of it. Everything was done only under their control, and that control was very poor. Of course, they were completely rejected, often in secret, by the Allies. The Entente said that they have to democratize their mentality. They have to change their goals and make them deeply democratic character. vigorously suppress all anti-Jewish movements. Then, and only then, will they receive support from the Entente, which of course wouldn't come anyway. The religious orientation of the pro-February Revolution white governments is very questionable. This is why Tikhon didn't give his blessing, ultimately. They only blessed, there's several, but they're in favor, of course. Anthony Kropovitsky was Keller in the Pskov region, and then, of course, Kolchak in 1919. But Denikin was out of the question. Russia was betrayed by the world powers. The British and the French were never their allies. The entire nature of World War I was how the British were able to force two natural allies, Germany and Russia, to fight one another. Because together, that was the worst nightmare of the British bankers. And of course, they used the Balkans as their pivot point. It was diabolically brilliant. The Bolsheviks were far more profitable to the Allies than the Whites were. Despite having competent leadership, the White forces had no coordination. They were given, despite having the money, no one was willing to sell them weaponry. But the Americans sold weapons to the Bolsheviks. It was very clear early on that the world powers supported the Reds. The use of extremely violent discipline in the Red forces helped them quite a bit. Forcing people at the barrel of a gun to serve the red cause. I mean, Trotsky himself said, terror is what this is how our army functions. We must put soldiers between possible death in front and inevitable death behind. So a retreat was meant with death. Advance was meant with death. This is how they pacified whole areas. Collective responsibility. Any retreat, every 10th Red Army soldier was shot. The end of the war, the Red Army was 5 million. The Whites in 1919, maybe 500,000. They used impressment, and of course, hundreds of thousands of foreigners, which is very rare for civil war. The role of the Red Cross. And to this day, you still have the prejudice that somehow liberal democracy is going to fight Marxism or ever wanted to fight Marxism. The British were trading with the Soviets long before the Soviet Union was actually proclaimed. The whole point of the independent Baltics was to allow the Bolsheviks to use them as middlemen to trade with the West. This was totally misunderstood by the Whites. Is a confusing, chaotic situation that doesn't really amend itself, is not amenable to quick and easy description. But this is how complicated these things really, truly are. And of course, the textbooks, your typical history, whether it be so-called conservative histories or leftist histories, are make-believe. This is one of these areas where highly specialized study is absolutely necessary. The problem with highly specialized study is that you end up being very confused. You lay out a narrative that has so many different parts that putting them all together is extremely difficult. The role of Freemasonry, the role of Judaism, there's no question about this. Finally, Denikin finally came to the realization that he was wrong about this. Anyway, thank you everyone for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.